Thanks for joining us again. I'm Gene Wilson, your host for this series on homosexuality, a Christian response. You've selected the third tape in this series, which is titled Answering the Pro-Gay Cultural Arguments. Our teacher is Joe Dallas. And tell me, Joe, exactly what are cultural arguments?
Gene, cultural arguments are the ones that we hear coming from leaders in the culture, as opposed to scientific or theological arguments, which we'll cover in tapes number 4 and 5. These are the arguments you're most likely to hear from the media or college campuses or just about any book or article that you pick up on homosexuality these days.
Arguments like, I was born gay, or 10% of the population is homosexual, or homosexuals cannot change, and so forth.
Exactly. These are the arguments most people are hearing. And even though so many of us feel that these arguments really aren't true, we're not sure how to respond to them.
Then let's look at some effective ways to respond to the pro-gay cultural arguments as we listen to the address you made to a conference of educators and pastors in New York.
Welcome to this workshop on responding to the pro-gay arguments. This is tape number 3 in our series on a Christian response to the issue of homosexuality. I remember nearly 30 years ago listening to Josh McDowell explain to a set of college students the need for having a clear response to the challenges to biblical authority. Well, what I'm hoping we can provide in this tape series is a clear response to the pro-gay arguments, one that is compassionate, that is, non-judgmental, absent the harshness that so often comes up in these discussions, but one that is also clear and reasonable. Well, in clarifying a Christian response to pro-gay arguments, let's first of all make the distinctions between facts and truth. I bring this up because so frequently in arguments over homosexuality, people who are taking a pro-gay, that is, an affirmative position on homosexuality, refer to alleged facts to bolster their arguments. One of my favorite films, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, begins with the professor, Indiana Jones, teaching an archaeology class, and he tells his students, this class is about facts. If you want truth, you go down the hall to Philosophy 101. In this class, we will simply study what is. Well, that's what facts do. They tell us what is, not necessarily what should be. Truth transcends facts. It includes facts, but it also includes a moral, spiritual dimension to the discussion. As for an example, a man may beat his wife. The fact is that he has hit her, he has injured her, he has hurt her. Those are facts. The truth of the matter transcends the facts. The truth includes the facts. Yes, indeed, he beat her. The truth also includes the moral, spiritual dimension. That is, he was wrong. He has committed a moral, spiritual transgression. So it is in the discussion on homosexuality. What I hope to provide in this workshop is a challenge first to the allegations that facts, that is, scientific data, are on the side of the pro-gay apologist. I want to, first of all, look at the alleged facts that the pro-gay arguments present and challenge those. And secondly, I want to look at the moral or spiritual implication of these alleged facts. Now, that second part of the equation is what I call the so what argument. For example, if someone says, I am born gay. Well, they're presenting a fact to me. Now, the first thing I would want to do is challenge the fact. Let's look at the data and let's see what science has to say thus far about homosexuality as to whether or not it's inborn. And let's see whether or not there is proof that you are indeed born a homosexual. But secondly, then, let's look at the larger issue, and that is what I call the so what argument. If a person is proven to have been born a homosexual, will that in and of itself normalize homosexuality? And as I hope to show, no, indeed it doesn't. Well, facts, or science if you will, tell us what is. they do not necessarily tell us what should be. So much of this discussion, then, is about the distinction between facts and truth, and about the problem of presenting evidence or suggestions as though they are facts, when in fact they are not. So in this tape, tape number 3, we'll be discussing the pro-gay arguments based on the nature of homosexuality itself. Specifically, whether or not homosexuality is inborn, whether or not homosexuality has been proven to be a normal condition, and finally, whether or not homosexuality is proven to be immutable or changeable. In our next tape, discussing the social values arguments, we'll be discussing society's response to homosexuality, but in this workshop, we're going to discuss the pro-gay arguments based on the nature of homosexuality itself. Now, to understand the pro-gay arguments, we do need to look a bit at the pro-gay movement, particularly in America. There has always been, of course, a homosexual population, just as there has always been such a thing as homosexuality. It's as old as the Bible. In fact, it's a good deal older. But in the United States, we didn't have what one would call an organized homosexual or gay rights movement until around the mid-1950s. Now, that is not to say that there wasn't a homosexual subculture. There certainly was. To an extent, it thrived. There were, even at that time, clubs, bars, different places where lesbians and gays could associate. But there was not a movement based on the identification of homosexuals as a group with specific demands until about the 1950s. Now, if you're interested in studying this further, let me refer you to Dr. Bayer's work. That's Dr. B-A-Y-E-R, titled Homosexuality and American Psychiatry, published in 1981. Dr. Bayer did an excellent job of reviewing the history of the gay rights movement in America, and he found in looking at the early writings of the movement that its initial request, or demands, if you will, were pretty modest. In the 1950s, two organizations developed. One was called the Mattachine Society, primarily composed of homosexual males, and the Daughters of Bilitis, a lesbian organization. The saying that was adopted by these groups was, quote, evolution without revolution. In other words, the groups specifically were seeking to gain greater acceptance and understanding from their culture without necessarily engaging in a revolution. And if you look at some of the early writings of these groups, you can see that much of what they were requesting was reasonable. In fact, most Christians would agree with many of the early goals of the gay rights movement. They were seeking fair treatment. They were saying, please don't beat us, commit acts of violence against us, call us names, treat us as though we are second-rate citizens. You may have the right to disagree with us, but please respect us as human beings. Well, what Christian, much less what decent human, could contradict those goals? Interestingly enough, according to Bayer, some of the early leaders in the early gay rights movement actually concurred with the prevailing psychiatric view of homosexuality at the time. And at times, in early gay rights meetings, they would refer to psychiatrists or psychologists who treated homosexuality and helped people to overcome it, and regarded that as something favorable. Some of them indeed recognized that homosexuality was abnormal and looked favorably on therapists who could offer treatment for it. And of course, there were those even within the early gay rights movement who disagreed and felt homosexuality should be legitimized. But it's interesting to note that at the beginning of the gay rights movement in America, there was not a uniform consensus that homosexuality was normal, that it was incurable, that those who sought to treat it should be somehow maligned or resisted, but rather there was a unanimous belief in fair treatment. And there was a request being made to the culture, reasonably and respectfully, that the culture treat homosexuals with the dignity and respect they deserved. And indeed, these were requests that any reasonable person would want to comply with. But around the mid-1960s, the plea for tolerance and fair treatment evolved into a demand for legitimization. Now, it should be remembered that the 60s were marked by turmoil, weren't they? My goodness, everything was up for grabs. This was a time our culture was questioning the very concept of normal and status quo. There was a movement among the youth that was overthrowing basic standards of sexual morality, of patriotism, respect for authority. There was campus unrest. We were engaged in a war that was escalating, that ideologically was ripping the country apart. We were in the throes of a civil rights movement and of a blossoming women's movement, feminist movement. It was a time of redefinition in America. It was a time when many people were looking at the status quo and saying, you know, just because something has traditionally been assumed to be so does not necessarily make it so. Now, against the backdrop of that sort of questioning, the early gay rights movement began to say, us too. We too now want to begin questioning whether or not heterosexuality should be considered the standard for normal behavior in all cases. And so the leadership in the early gay rights movement became increasingly aggressive. And it began to basically develop a platform that no longer said, please treat us fairly, but rather it said, gay is good. And we are going to fight until our culture affirms our belief in the goodness, in the normality of homosexuality. This marked a radical, significant shift in thought in the early gay rights movement. And that developed, of course, the demand for the legitimization of homosexuality. Now, you know and I know that in a democratic culture, you cannot simply make a demand and expect people to abandon their deeply held beliefs, to comply with that demand. You have to persuade people of the legitimacy of your demand. Martin Luther King was brilliant at persuading people of the legitimacy of his demand for fair treatment of all people, regardless of race. Gandhi was brilliant at persuading people of the legitimacy of his demand that the British relinquish the unnecessary control they were wielding over his people. And so the gay rights movement began attempting to persuade our culture of the legitimacy of their demands. How is a culture persuaded? Well, with persuasive arguments. Thus, the development of pro-gay arguments. Now, pro-gay arguments are based to a large extent on the concept of sympathy for the underdog. Now, there's something in American consciousness that seems to respond to any group that is being mistreated. I think part of that is because of our own dark history of mistreating, at different times, minority groups. Bigotry makes us queasy. One of the worst things that can be said about someone is that they are bigoted, that they are racist, that they are sexist, that they are homophobic, that they are intolerant. We have a particular disdain for people who would subjugate other people and mistreat them. If you can prove that you as a group are being mistreated, if you can persuade people to see you as an underdog, you already have a tremendous edge in the debate. Because the person who is seen as the victim, the one who is being mistreated, automatically generates a tremendous sympathy. And oftentimes, people will vote, people will respond, people will act based more on sympathy than on reason. Just for example, let me read you a strategy that was promoted by homosexual authors Kirk and Madsen in their book After the Ball. And the book is basically a how-to book on gay strategy. And in their book, they promote the notion that the gay victim is one of the most powerful arguments for the gay rights movement. Quote, "The purpose of gay victim imagery is to make heterosexuals feel very uncomfortable. Gays should be portrayed as victims of prejudice. Heterosexuals must be shown graphic pictures of brutalized gays, dramatizations of job and housing insecurities, loss of child custody, public humiliation, etc." End quote. That's gay authors Kirk and Madsen in their book After the Ball. When you present an argument based on the victimhood of the person you are arguing for, you elicit tremendous sympathy. In this argument, the American public is the jury. The defense for the gay community is the pro-gay apologist who is promoting homosexuality as a normal condition and promoting the notion that to resist that belief is to be guilty of bigotry. Well, one of the best ways to do that, of course, is to promote an alleged fact as though it is a proven fact. Three alleged facts we're going to look at in this workshop. First, the notion that people are born homosexual. Secondly, the notion that homosexuality has been proven to be a normal, natural condition. And third, the alleged fact that homosexuality is immutable. An editorialist named William Cheshire wrote in the Arizona Republic, quote, "My feelings about gays and lesbians were dominated by religious beliefs, but after reviewing studies proving that homosexuals were born that way, I did a complete reversal in my attitude towards gays and lesbians and began actively promoting anti-discrimination laws for gays." End quote. Evidently, the born gay argument has gained momentum because of the implication that if a condition is inborn, it is automatically normal. Some 30 years ago, when lesbians and gays were surveyed about their beliefs on homosexuality and how they became homosexual, a minority of them reported a belief that they were born that way. But as the movement has become more politicized, more and more lesbians and gays have adopted the notion that homosexuality is inborn. And indeed, more studies have purported to have proven that homosexuality is an inborn condition. Let's look at two of the most well-known studies on homosexuality as an inborn phenomenon. These are the studies you will normally hear about when someone tells you that homosexuals are born that way. The first is the study by Dr. Simon LeBay. The second is the study by Drs. Pillard and Bailey. Both of these received a tremendous amount of press back in the early 1990s, and they have been repeated as studies proving that homosexuality is an inborn condition. Now, Dr. Simon LeBay, in 1991, published in Science Journal a study that he had conducted on the brains of 41 cadavers. 19 of the cadavers he studied had allegedly been homosexual men when they were alive. 16 were allegedly heterosexual men, and 6 were allegedly heterosexual women. I use the word allegedly because, of course, Dr. LaVey did not know for certain what the sexual orientation of his subjects had been. After all, they had died. In some of their paperwork, some of them had indicated they were homosexual. 19 of the men specifically said so in their reports. The rest of them did not say for sure one way or another, and there was no way of knowing that. Regardless, Dr. LaVey studied the hypothalamus of these bodies and discovered that in a certain percentage of the homosexual men, a portion of the hypothalamus called the INAH3 seemed to be smaller than that of the heterosexual men. Now, likewise, the INAH3 portion of the heterosexual women appeared to be smaller than that of the heterosexual men. And the implication Dr. LaVey put forth is that the INAH3 has a good deal to do with sexual orientation and the object of sexual attraction, and that those who are attracted to men, whether they are homosexual men or heterosexual women, tend to have a smaller INAH3 than heterosexual men who are attracted to women. Now, to Dr. LaVey's credit, he admitted that he had by no means proven that homosexuality is inborn. Rather, he had simply observed the brain structures of homosexual men, heterosexual men, and heterosexual women. And from those observations, he had indicated that a certain portion of the brain of homosexual men was smaller than that of heterosexual men. The media failed to report with clarity Dr. LaVey's categorical denial of having proven that homosexuality is inborn. Rather, we began to hear reports, newscasts, we began to read in the newspapers, front page stories and magazine cover stories indicating that homosexuality had now been proven to be an inborn condition. And when a story like that is passed on enough times, it becomes to be taken as a fact, when in fact, Dr. LaVey by no means proved homosexuality to be inborn, and in fact has said so on several occasions since then. Let's look at the facts themselves. Dr. LaVey set out to find a genetic or a biological cause for homosexuality. He very plainly stated, again to his credit, that when he began his research, he had recently lost his own lover to AIDS. Dr. LaVey is openly gay, had a male partner who had died, and after losing his partner, he went on record saying that he was, quote, determined to prove a genetic base for homosexuality or he would abandon science altogether, end quote. So clearly, Dr. LaVey was not approaching the subject objectively. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we should disregard his research, but it should be considered that he himself had a specific agenda when he began that research. Now, on the surface, it would appear that by finding a difference in brain structures between homosexual and heterosexual men, that Dr. LaVey had proven homosexuality to be inborn. That is by no means the case, though, because in fact, the homosexual subjects in at least 3 cases actually had a larger brain structure than the heterosexuals. Now, the newspapers reported Dr. LaVey's results as though all of the homosexual subjects had a smaller hypothalamus, all of the heterosexual subjects had a larger one. Not so. 3 of the homosexual subjects actually had a larger INAH3 than the heterosexuals. 3 of the heterosexual subjects actually had smaller INAH3s than the average homosexual subject, so the results were by no means uniform. That in and of itself discounts the notion that in all cases homosexuality is inspired by brain structure. Secondly, a point that was indicated by several scientists when Dr. LaVey's study came out, it really is unclear to what extent our brain structure affects our behavior versus to what extent our behavior influences our brain structures. We do know, according to Dr. Kenneth Clivington of the Salk Institute, where Dr. LaVey also practiced, that brain change occurs throughout life as a consequence of experience. Which begs the question, is the brain structure affected by the homosexual behavior, or is the homosexual behavior influenced or inspired by the brain structure? That we do not know. We also don't know to what extent the AIDS virus affected the brain structures of the patients, all of whom had died of AIDS. And, of course, Dr. LaVey himself has admitted that that represented a distinct shortcoming in his study. Dr. Rochelle Klinger, a psychiatrist at the Medical College of Virginia, went on record as saying that she doubts we will ever find a single cause of homosexuality, and Scientific American summed up the reason many professionals approach this INAH theory with a bit of caution when they said, quote, LaVey's study has yet to be fully replicated by another researcher. Nonetheless, on the heels of Dr. LaVey's study was released a study of twins done by Drs. Pillard and Bailey. Now, Dr. Pillard and Bailey did not study the brain structures of homosexual people, but rather they put out an advertisement in homosexual publications asking for anyone who was gay and had an identical or a fraternal twin to come in to be interviewed to determine if there was a higher incidence of homosexuality between identical twins than among fraternal twins. If identical twins were shown to have a higher incidence of homosexuality, the argument goes, that would indicate that there is a genetic cause for the homosexual orientation. And indeed, Drs. Pillard and Bailey found that 52% of homosexual men who had an identical twin had a twin who was also homosexual, as opposed to only 20% of homosexuals who had a fraternal twin, the implication being that homosexuality is indeed genetic. Interestingly enough, in an interview I appeared in where Dr. LaVey was also a subject, Dr. LaVey referred to these twin studies as proof that homosexuality is not inborn, because he said if homosexuality was genetic, Drs. Pillard and Bailey would have found a much higher percentage of homosexual identical twins than the 52% figure. The fact that 48% of the homosexual men who had identical twins had an identical twin who was heterosexual indeed indicated that something in the environment also inspires homosexuality. A distinct shortcoming as well of the Pillard and Bailey study is that the twins who were studied were all raised in the same household. Dr. Ann Fausto Sterling of Brown University pointed out that for a study like this to be meaningful, you'd have to study twins who had been raised apart. Besides all of which, the following year, the following spring, in fact, the British Journal of Psychiatry published a report on homosexual twins and yielded results very different from Pillard and Bailey's, in which they found that only 20% of the homosexual men who had an identical twin had a twin who shared their homosexual orientation. Facts and truth. Well, the fact is, homosexuality has not been proven to be inborn. When the pro-gay argument indicates that homosexuality has been proven once and for all to be an inborn condition, that alleged fact needs to be challenged. The facts at this point do not support the case. That is not to say that we will never find evidence for a genetic or biological genesis of homosexuality. It is possible, I think it's not likely, but it is possible that someday a study, I should say a series of studies, because studies need to be replicated before we accept them wholeheartedly, may show somehow that there is such a thing as a genetic predisposition towards homosexuality. They may find a gay gene. they may find some chemistry in the brain that inspires homosexual orientation. That may one day be proven as a fact. What impact would that have on the Christian position of homosexuality? Virtually none. Homosexuality? The scripture seems to assume that as a fallen race, the fallen nature affects us body, soul, and spirit. And so we recognize that there is such a thing as physical imperfection. There is even such a thing as birth defect. As a matter of fact, recent research on a variety of behaviors indicates that there are certain unacceptable behaviors or tendencies that may indeed be inborn. Studies at the City of Hope, for example, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, indicate that there may well be a genetic predisposition towards alcoholism. It seems clear now that there's a genetic predisposition towards depression. Quite a few court cases have come up lately where the defense argues that the person who committed a violent crime while being guilty of having committed that crime also was predisposed towards violence by a certain genetic structure or malformation, and that because this person's genetic predisposition towards violence enhanced his capacity for violence, he should not be held accountable for that behavior. About 6 years ago, Time magazine ran a cover story, I loved it, that said, "Adultery, it may be in our genes." And the article went on to purport that men may be genetically programmed towards promiscuity, that we are naturally inclined to spread our seed to several different recipients, that that is an evolutionary law, and that women need to just accept the fact that men are naturally promiscuous. And men around the country showed the magazine to their wives and said, "You see, honey, it's not my fault." All of which begs the question, how far do we take this? Well, we are not going to rewrite the standards on promiscuity, drunkenness, or violent behavior to legitimize those behaviors if they are proven to be genetic in origin. Moral standards are not subject to the recent genetic findings that may indicate that people are naturally inclined towards immoral behavior. As a matter of fact, findings like that only confirm what we have always known. We're a fallen race, affected by the sin nature. And part of that sin nature may indeed express itself in inborn tendencies. Inborn, though, does not automatically mean normal, nor does inborn mean God-ordained or God-created. The question should never be, is a tendency inborn? The question remains, is the tendency and the behavior it inspires right or wrong in and of itself? The second argument we want to look at in this workshop is the argument that proposes that homosexuality has been normalized by the American Psychiatric Association. Commonly, when you're listening to an interview on television or radio, where two guests are debating the legitimacy of homosexuality, the person taking the pro-gay position will say, "You know, back in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association declared that homosexuality is normal. Therefore, since 1973, we have as a culture known that homosexual behavior is as normal and healthy as heterosexual behavior, and that should be the end of the argument." Now, like many arguments, this one is based on a very simplistic view of the APA's decision in 1973. It is true that in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association, in essence, normalized homosexuality in a landmark decision. But the events leading to that decision are significant and need to be reviewed. Secondly, the decision itself didn't give quite the blessing to homosexual behavior that many people assume that it did. Besides all of which, there's still a tremendous amount of division within the ranks of membership of the American Psychiatric Association as to whether or not homosexuality represents normal behavior. Let's look first of all at how the APA reached this decision in 1973. Remember the backdrop of the times, the late 60s, early 70s, when this decision was reached. Remember the upheaval we were in as a culture. Remember the burgeoning power of the gay rights movement. As I mentioned earlier, in the mid-1960s, the gay rights movement officially adopted a quote-unquote gay is good position. And with that position came a commitment to convincing the culture that homosexuality is normal. Riding on the heels of the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, and so forth. Every movement needs an opponent. Movements are strengthened by their opposition. For example, I remember when I myself was a part of the gay rights movement in the late 1970s, we were prone to say to each other, if Anita Bryant didn't exist, we'd have needed to invent her. An opponent mobilizes a movement. It pulls people together. Now, if the early gay rights movement was seeking to legitimize homosexuality in America, what was standing in the way? Well, at that time, primarily, it was the deeply held belief among clinicians that homosexual behavior represented some form of abnormality. And so the opponent of the early gay rights movement was the psychiatric profession. The psychiatric profession yielded influence. If it, as an organization, could be persuaded to change its position on homosexuality, then the gay rights movement would be given virtually a green light in American culture. After all, if the mental health experts say something is normal, the culture tends to follow suit and say, well, if the professionals say it's so, it must be so. And so the American Psychiatric Association was targeted in the late 1960s as an opponent whose mind needed to be changed on the issue of homosexuality. Many spokespersons for the pro-gay position would have you believe that after reasoned dialogue, discussion, and the review of clinical research, the APA changed its position in 1973 and said, oops, we were wrong. Based on the data we have received, we now recognize homosexuality to be normal. The pro-gay apologist would have you believe that the clinicians involved in the leadership of the APA sat down, objectively looked at the material, and came to a rational conclusion. Not so. Dr. Ronald Baer, who researched ad infinitum, the events leading to and surrounding this landmark 1973 decision, and who, by the way, is strongly sympathetic towards the gay rights movement, makes an interesting observation about the process by which the APA reached its decision. And here I quote from his book, Homosexuality and the Psychiatry Politics. Quote, "The entire process, from the first confrontation organized by gay demonstrators to the referendum demanded by Orthodox psychiatrists, seemed to violate the most basic expectations about how questions of science should be resolved. Instead of being engaged in sober discussions of data, psychiatrists were swept up in a political controversy. The result was not a conclusion based on an approximation of the scientific truth as dictated by reason, but was instead an action demanded by the ideological temper of the times." Ronald Baer, Homosexuality in American Psychiatry, The Politics of Diagnosis. Ronald Baer, again, who writes with great sympathy for the gay rights movement, who applauds the APA's decision, who believes homosexuality is normal. Even he has emphasized that the result of the APA's decision was not a conclusion based on an approximation of scientific truth, but instead an action demanded by the ideological temper of the times. A decision enhanced more by politics than by reason. How was this done? Well, initially, once the gay rights movement determined that the APA was its opponent, whose opinion had to be changed, they began borrowing some of the tactics of the civil rights movement and, in a more confrontational sense, the anti-Vietnam War movement and the women's movement, and began protesting meetings of the American Psychiatric Association and other behavioral organizations. Now, not only did they begin protesting the meetings, they actually began disrupting the meetings. And so in 1969, both in San Francisco and then later in New York, gay activists literally invaded the meetings of the leadership of the American Psychiatric Association, yanking the microphone away from the speakers, heckling the doctors when they were doing presentations, virtually decimating the order of the meetings that these clinicians had come to attend, and warning them that unless they allowed gay activists to participate in their future official discussions on homosexuality, they could look forward to more treatment of this sort. In essence, through intimidation and threats of more intimidation, gay activists succeeded in participating in clinical discussions with professionals. This was unprecedented. Never before in the history of the APA had non-clinicians been allowed to participate, not just as guest speakers, but as co-participants in panels discussing clinical issues. Gay activists who were not licensed, who were not degreed, who only had a passionate interest in the subject, were allowed to participate in discussions on the legitimacy of removing homosexuality from the list of disorders. Under threat of further coercion, the APA allowed gay activists to begin participating in debates, discussions, and official dialogues. For the next 3 years from that initial disruption of the APA's conference, outlined again in Bayer's work and repeated in other books as well, gay activists were able to begin persuading the leadership of the APA to remove homosexuality from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Now, the DSM, as it is called, was developed in 1952. It's virtually the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association in that it delineates different diseases and disorders. From its inception in 1952, homosexuality was listed as a disorder. In 1968, it was moved into the category of sexual deviation. In 1973, the APA voted to remove it from the DSM altogether. When that decision was reached in 1973, the official APA statement on homosexuality did not, however, say that homosexuality is normal. Rather, it said that homosexuality, although it may represent suboptimal functioning, did not necessarily represent pathology. If the homosexual person was functional in other parts of life and felt no subjective distress about his or her homosexuality, then the APA had no business classifying that as a disorder. In essence, the APA did not only remove homosexuality, but it revised its own definition of mental illness when it said, and I quote here, that suboptimal functioning did not necessarily represent pathology. By no means were they saying homosexuality is normal. They were in essence saying that even if it represented suboptimal functioning, that in and of itself was not enough to keep it classified as a disorder. As soon as that decision was reached by the Board of Trustees of the APA in 1973, a referendum was called for in which over 10,000 members of the APA voted, 40% of whom stated that they disagreed with the APA's decision to delete homosexuality from the DSM. Now, 40% is a minority, quite true. But it is a significant percentage showing that at the time there was deep division among clinicians as to whether or not homosexuality was normal or abnormal. By no means had the APA, quote-unquote, seen the light and revised its position wholesale on homosexuality. Interestingly enough, in a poll of over 10,000 psychiatrists done 6 years later, in 1979, a question was asked of them saying, do you believe that homosexuality represents, and I quote, a pathological adaptation? 6 years after the APA voted to remove homosexuality from its list of disorders, 69% of the psychiatrists polled said yes, they believed homosexuality represented a pathological adaptation. Did the Board of Trustees of the American Psychiatric Association vote to delete homosexuality from the list of disorders? Yes, it did. Did the psychiatric industry change its mind on homosexuality? No, it did not. And to this day, there is still a tremendous division among professionals as to whether or not homosexuality is normal, abnormal, treatable, or non-treatable. The fact is, yes indeed, the APA changed its official position. The truth is, that in and of itself did not legitimize homosexuality, both in the minds of professionals or laity. The final argument we want to look at in this workshop is the argument based on the alleged immutability of homosexuality. A common argument heard from the pro-gay apologist is, I tried to change, I was unable to change, therefore I have concluded homosexuality is normal. In fact, many pro-gay apologists would suggest that all studies on sexual orientation have proven that sexual orientation cannot be changed. Now, at first glance, these alleged facts fly in the face of what the Scripture says about sexual orientation when in 1 Corinthians 6:9, Paul makes it clear that certain types of behavior prohibit people from entering into the kingdom of God. And so he tells the Corinthian church, don't be deceived, neither fornicators, adulterers, liars, swindlers, thieves, covetous, nor homosexuals shall inherit the kingdom of God. And then he says, such were, past tense, some of you. Indicating that as long ago as the time 1 Corinthians was written in the New Testament, homosexuals were indeed changing. Fast forward to 1998, and we find that some segments of both the American Psychiatric and the American Psychological Association are coming out with official statements saying that homosexuality is proven to be immutable and that it can actually be damaging to try to do exactly what St. Paul in the New Testament said was being done, and that is to change one's sexual orientation, to go from being a homosexual to a heterosexual. How did we reach that point? How did we get to a place where not only in gay leadership, but in leadership across the country, both in the education and the psychiatric industry, people are saying that it is an assumed fact that homosexuals cannot change? I think the answer lies in what one former homosexual has said on record, quote, homosexual activists want to convince not only the public, but themselves that change never occurs. Because if I exist, each of them must be haunted by the possibility that they, too, might find the power to change. Well, let's look first at the facts then, and then at the truth. Has it been proven that homosexuality is immutable? No, far from it. Freud himself, who took a rather sympathetic view towards homosexuals, indicated that homosexuality was a changeable condition in a famous letter written to the mother of a homosexual who was hoping that Dr. Freud could convert her son. Freud wrote back expressing what seems like an ambiguity about homosexuality, but was really, I think, a rather fair position when he said, look, homosexuality is certainly not a virtue, but many fine people have been homosexual. He said, we do believe that it represents a stunting in development. And then he said, at times through analysis, we have been able to revive the blighted germinations of heterosexuality that exist in every homosexual, saying, of course, that he believed homosexuality was not necessarily an immutable condition. Well, that was a view held by psychiatrist and analyst for several years and continues to be held by many. Dr. Irving Bieber, in the 1960s, treated more than 100 homosexuals and went on record as saying that, quote, a heterosexual shift is a possibility for all homosexuals who are strongly motivated to change. Dr. Ruben Fine of the New York Center for Psychoanalytic Training said that there is misinformation spread by certain circles that homosexuality is untreatable, and he said that that information did, quote, incalculable harm to thousands of people. Sex researchers Masters and Johnson, and they're hardly a pair of standard bearers for conservative values, said in their landmark 1979 study that the concept that homosexuality cannot be changed is certainly open to question. Doctors Wood and Dietrich wrote that all studies that have attempted to convert homosexuals to heterosexuals have had significant success. And I don't think anyone says it better than Dr. Stanton Jones, who is the chair of psychology at Wheaton College, when he says, anyone who says there is no hope for change of sexual orientation is either ignorant or lying. Every secular study of change has shown some success rate, and persons who testify to substantial healings are indeed legion. Interestingly enough, in 1970, the Kinsey Institute confirmed this, although the Kinsey Institute takes a strong pro-gay position, when they reported that 84% of the homosexuals they studied had shifted their sexual orientation at least once, 32% of them reported a second shift, 13% reported five changes of their sexual orientation during their lifetime. Fact. No, indeed, it has not been proven that homosexuality is immutable. Just the opposite. We have always found that people who are motivated to change have the capacity to do so. The fact also is that change is difficult. Many people who attempt to change their sexual orientation engage, to some extent, in a lifelong struggle. Interestingly enough, there are gay apologists who would say that if someone is not completely changed, they haven't changed at all, which flies in the face of common sense about both psychotherapy and physical change. If I'm 300 pounds overweight and I lose 150 pounds, I changed. Am I still overweight? Yeah. But I'm 150 pounds lighter than I was before. Did I change completely? No. But I sure changed. If I go to therapy for depression, and I end therapy less depressed than I was before, and I still to some extent wrestle with some depression, was the therapy useless? No, of course not. I improved. Did I change completely? No. So it is with homosexuals who enter into therapy. Many homosexuals who go for therapeutic help will find that to some extent they still wrestle with homosexuality. Was the therapy a failure? No, indeed. Many of them learn what to do with the homosexual passions when they arise. Many of them understand their condition better and are better able to manage it. So no, indeed, it has not been proven that homosexuality is immutable, nor has it been proven that if someone doesn't change entirely, they did not change at all. But transcending those facts even is the truth. The truth is that even if a condition is difficult to change or impossible to change, that, in and of itself, cannot legitimize the condition. We know that the alcoholic or the drug addict will probably, for their lifetime, wrestle with some urges towards their old addictions and compulsions. We know that St. Paul seemed to have some sort of a thorn in the side that he couldn't get rid of. That didn't necessarily mean it was normal. In fact, he said it had been sent to him by Satan. We know the human condition is such that we can always return to a prior unhealthy behavior or way of relating. That in and of itself doesn't legitimize the condition or the behavior. These alleged facts about homosexuality, the alleged fact that it is inborn, the alleged fact that it is proven to be normal, the alleged fact that it is immutable, they are all subject to debate. but even if all of them could be proven to be true, if the scientist were to prove to us that homosexuality is inborn, if the sociologist were to prove to us that homosexuality is normal, and if the gay activist were to prove to us that homosexuality is unchangeable, that would not change the biblical position, which states that no matter how it is created, no matter how a culture normalizes it, and no matter how difficult it is to change, it remains an immoral and unnatural way of relating. In this, we might do well to take our cue from the kosher packaging company, which says that regardless of what other people say about their product, they, like we, answer to a higher power.
Thank you for joining us in this six-part series on homosexuality, A Christian Response. If you'd like more copies of this tape series, please contact us at American Family Living at 1774 North LaSalle Street, Orange, California, 92865, or call us at 714-637-7900. We have a lovely webpage which includes Genesis counseling. You can reach us both at www.AmericanFamilyLiving.org. If you'd like to contact Joe Dallas directly for counseling or to have him speak at your church or conference, he can be reached at Genesis Counseling at 1774 North LaSalle Street, Orange, California, 92865. You can also reach him at his voicemail, 714-502-1463. That's 714-502-1463. We put this series together as a tool for you and would love to hear from you. Please take a moment to contact us and let us know if this series has been helpful to you. We appreciate your prayers for Genesis and American Family Living. Thank you for joining Joe and I, and God bless you.